WFSU-FM now presents a delayed broadcast of the Village Square Community Forum of October 7th, 2014 at St. John's Episcopal Church in Tallahassee. Here's Village Square Executive Director Liz Joyner.
On behalf of the Village Square and our partners, the League of Women Voters of Tallahassee and the Tallahassee Democrat, we'd like to welcome you to Amendments 101, a regular election year program we have to help you painlessly as possible navigate what will be on the ballot in the fall. We will be joined tonight by a live stream audience at Tallahassee.com, and a radio audience will be listening to the program with WFSU. Tonight's program will first feature a pro-con rundown of all three of the amendments on the Florida ballot this fall by League of Women Voters of Florida Executive Director Jessica Lowe Minor. I want to direct your attention to the newspapers on the tables. They are the amendments publication by the League of Women Voters of Florida, and they always put out the most comprehensive information on the amendments, pro and con. So I'd encourage you to take a copy of that home with you to supplement tonight's discussion. Please also note that the League of Women Voters FSU chapter is hosting an individual forum on each of these three amendments in the coming weeks. They are all at the FSU Center for Global and Multicultural Engagement on Woodward Avenue. The first one is October 15th on Amendment 1. That's at 7 o'clock. October 21st on Amendment 2 at 7 o'clock. And October 28th on Amendment 3 at 7:30. Following Jessica's presentation and question and answers on the state amendments, we'll begin a panel discussion on the local ethics ballot measure. It's now my pleasure to introduce the League of Women Voters of Florida Executive Director Jessica Lowe Minor.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. I just want to say a quick note about the League of Women Voters of Florida. This is our favorite season. Many Floridians come to us and say, oh, we hate election season. We're tired of all the negative ads. When will it end? And the League of Women Voters just gets so excited because this is the time when we get to talk to folks about being educated and informed voters and making sure that folks are prepared to cast their vote. So this is just a quick presentation. It'll take about 15 to 20 minutes to go through the three constitutional amendments that are on the ballot this year. I think we all have nightmares from 2012 when we had 11 legislatively generated constitutional amendments on the ballot. And I have really good news that we only have three this year. Two of them were put forward by citizens, and one was put forward by the legislature. So it's a much more straightforward and easy to understand and easy to vote ballot this year. So just a little bit of information about the League of Women Voters. We do date back to 1920. We were founded actually in anticipation of the 19th Amendment passing. So we were very optimistic that that would happen, and of course it did. And we have started accepting men into the League. Men can join. They started joining in 1974. So we welcome men and women into the organization. We have a policy of nonpartisanship. So we have never, as an organization, endorsed a political party or a candidate. We never expect to do that. We do, however, take positions on issues after our members have done extensive research on those topics and have come to consensus on what the League's position should be. We have 30 local leagues throughout the state, including one here in Tallahassee, which I hope you will all join. Okay, so what is on the ballot in November? Of course, you're going to be voting on congressional seats. There's a very contested race here in the Big Bend area between incumbent Steve Sutherland and challenger Gwen Graham. You'll also be voting on the governor. That's very clear from all the negative ads that you've been seeing. You'll be voting on your entire state cabinet. So the attorney general, the chief financial officer, and the commissioner of agriculture are all on the ballot. As well as races for state senate and house. I don't think actually you might or might not have a contested race at this point in the Big Bend area. And then you'll have questions on judicial merit retention, of course, the constitutional amendments, and city and county elections and referendums, which you'll hear a little bit more about tonight. Okay, so proposed constitutional amendments. Florida's constitution is different than the federal constitution. Sometimes that's something that voters get confused, but it does do the same basic thing. It establishes basic rules and rights that we have as Floridians. And in some cases, the Florida constitution gives us protections that are even beyond what the federal constitution offers. So that's something to think about and to have appreciation for our state constitution. Ballot amendments are proposed changes to the constitution, and they have to be approved by 60% or more of the electorate to pass. So that was the change that was made relatively recently. So you do have to have a supermajority to pass a constitutional amendment now. There are several ways for an amendment to be placed on the ballot. So it could be placed on by the legislature by a 3/5 majority of both chambers. A citizen initiative, you can have a group of citizens that put something on the ballot before the voters. It's pretty complicated to do that. You have to collect over 600,000 signatures in order to get that that done. So it's a very long and expensive process. There's also a Constitutional Revision Commission that meets, I believe, every 20 years, and that's actually coming up relatively soon. There'll be another Constitutional Revision Commission. The Taxation and Budget Reform Commission can propose amendments to the Constitution, and a Constitutional Convention could be called for by the citizens. I don't think there has been one in Florida's history, but that doesn't mean that we could not do it tonight. So think about that if you're getting exhausted with these constitutional amendments. Okay. Amendment 1. This is known as Florida's Water and Land Legacy Amendment. This was a citizen petition. You've probably heard quite a bit about this one. They've been collecting petitions for quite some time. This is an image that is pretty interesting. This is the same spring. On the right side, you'll see Levy Blue Springs in 1992, and on the left side, you'll see it in 2011. And you can tell that there's a pretty remarkable difference in the quality of the water from 1992 to 2011. And it's this type of image that has kind of led the citizens who put Amendment 1 together, that led them to conclude that maybe this was something that was needed. So Amendment 1 is a citizen initiative sponsored by environmental groups as well as other citizen organizations. And the background, so until recently, Florida's Land Acquisition Trust Fund received bipartisan support using proceeds from the documentary stamp tax. And the doc stamp tax is a source of revenue for the state that's generated primarily from real estate transactions. So when you, purchase a new home or there's a lien, there's some kind of, change of ownership, there's a tax on that documentation. And so that is where the money for the Land Acquisition Trust Fund has come from. Over the past several years, though, funds from this tax have been diverted to other uses. And of course, we have had a recession, and the state budget has taken quite a hit. And during that time period, we saw money that at one point had been going towards the Land Acquisition Trust Fund go towards other areas of the budget. So what Amendment 1 would do is it would dedicate 33% of the documentary stamp tax revenue over the next 20 years towards environmental purposes. And so that money would essentially be cordoned off and placed in a very specific silo, and it could only go towards either acquiring new conservation land or maintaining and preserving land that already exists. So that's something that would basically ensure that money could not go towards other parts of the budget. So a vote yes would provide a long-term funding mechanism for environmental conservation without a new tax. This is a tax that already exists. It would remove reliance on yearly legislative funding for water and land conservation projects, and it would enhance publicly held recreational lands, possibly contributing to economic growth through increased tourism. So a vote no would not establish this long-term funding mechanism for environmental conservation, and it would retain the legislature's ability to make budgetary decisions on a year-to-year basis. So in those years when funding is tight and, the legislature is trying to balance priorities, they would maintain the ability to say, okay, well, we really can't afford to put money towards springs restoration this year. We need to put it towards K-12 education, or we need to put it towards building new roads, or whatever their priority was at that time. So they would still have that flexibility to use all of the areas of the budget towards whatever their priorities were during a given year. A vote no would also not place language in the Florida Constitution relating to environmental conservation where it would be difficult to modify or remove. Once something is in the Constitution, it's in there. The only way for you to change it is, again, for the citizens to vote on it. So it would take, quite a bit to change it once it's in. So this is a list of supporting organizations. You can see in full transparency that the League of Women Voters of Florida is one of the organizations that has supported this amendment. At this time, the Florida Chamber of Commerce is the only organization that we know of that's opposed. However, there might be others. We just don't have any record of organizations besides the Chamber taking a formal position against. Okay, Amendment 2, and I will take questions at the end, so if folks have questions, please save them. So Amendment 2, this is probably the most exciting amendment on the ballot. It relates to medical marijuana. This is also a citizen initiative. This initiative is sponsored by People United for Medical Marijuana. So a little bit of background. During the 2014 session, the legislature did pass a law that would allow for the medicinal use of Charlotte's Web, which is a non-psychoactive form of cannabis. So there is a little bit of a debate going on right now as to whether or not, medical marijuana is already legal in the state, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, there was a type of medical marijuana that was legalized during the 2014 session. What Amendment 2 would do is that it would legalize all forms of marijuana for medical use. So Amendment 2 enables physicians to authorize the use of medical marijuana by their patients. So essentially, a physician would diagnose a patient with a chronic debilitating medical disorder. That person would be issued an identification card by the Department of Health. So the Department of Health would be the statutory agency that would have to regulate this amendment and or this newly enacted part of the Constitution if it's passed. And they would have to issue identification cards to patients who are diagnosed with a medical, debilitating medical condition, and also to patients' caregivers. So if, for example, you were someone who was disabled as a result of your illness, but you had someone who took care of you, that person would also have an identification card so that they could purchase your medical cannabis for you and bring it back. It applies only to Florida residents, so you could not come from Georgia or Alabama or elsewhere in order to purchase medical marijuana. It also prohibits the operation of a car or a boat while under the influence. So that's been a question that people have had of, what happens with people who are driving or operating, heavy machinery? There would still be restrictions that would prohibit you from using those machines or whatnot while you're under the influence. And also employers or workplaces, schools would be able to prevent you from using medical marijuana on their premises. Okay, so a vote yes would provide for the legal use of marijuana for medical purposes by individuals with debilitating diseases as diagnosed by a licensed Florida physician. It would maintain the current prohibition on marijuana use for recreational purposes. So recreational use would still be illegal even if Amendment 2 was passed. And it would also require the Department of Health to monitor centers that produce and distribute marijuana for medical purposes and to issue identification cards to patients and caregivers. A vote no would not affect the current prohibition on marijuana use in the state of Florida. It would say the same. Charlotte's Web would still be legal for folks who are needing that and have a prescription for that. It would also maintain the status quo as it relates to enforcement of the marijuana laws currently on the books. So a vote no means nothing would change in that regard. And finally, a vote no would not place language in the Florida Constitution relating to medical marijuana, where, again, it would be difficult to modify or remove. So it would keep that issue out of the Constitution one way or the other. So these are organizations that we know are currently on record supporting Amendment 2. And these are organizations that have come out in opposition. And the League of Women Voters of Florida has not taken a position on Amendment 2 one way or the other. Okay, so Amendment 3, this is one of the most complicated amendments to understand on this year's ballot. So it relates to judicial vacancies. It's something that people are a little bit unclear on, but it also is one that has potentially a very huge impact for the state, so it's quite important. So this is the single legislatively generated amendment on this year's ballot. And basically what this does, or a little bit of background about Amendment 3. So appointments to the Supreme Court and District Courts of Appeal are made by the governor using a list that's generated by the Judicial Nominating Commission. And there are 26 Judicial Nominating Commissions. They're called JNCs, or abbreviated as JNCs. And they each relate to the specific District Court of Appeal, or in the case of the Supreme Court, the specific court that they're responsible for identifying prospective candidates for. So if you have a vacancy on the Supreme Court Judicial Nominating Commission will put together a list of qualified applicants. They'll ask for applications, they'll conduct interviews, and then at the end of their whole process, they will submit a list to the governor of 3 to 6 candidates, and the governor has to select someone from that list. So the governor is limited in his or her options to only people who were on the JNC's initial list. So from that perspective, the JNC has quite a lot of power over who ultimately will end up either on a district court of appeals or on the Supreme Court. The kind of caveat, though, is that the governor hand selects everyone who's on the JNC. So there are 9 members of the JNC. 5 of them are appointed by the governor just outright, and 4 of them are appointed, are basically appointed by the Florida Bar, except if the Florida Bar sends a list of people to the governor for him to put on the JNC and he does not like those people, he can say, no, send me a new list. And so that's actually something that recently happened. You might have seen that in the news, is that the Florida Bar had submitted lists of candidates for the Judicial Nominating Commissions to Governor Scott, and he actually sent those lists back and asked for new names. So ultimately what happens is that all 9 people end up being candidates who were either appointed directly or approved by the governor. So that's something that happens. You know, those terms last every 4 years. So a JNC member, once appointed, will stay on for 4 years, and then whomever is the governor at the time that their appointment runs out will either reappoint them or will select someone new. So why Amendment 3? What's the issue that has caused Amendment 3 to come forward? Well, so we talked about once a vacancy occurs, the governor will go to the JNC and say, okay, we have a vacancy. The JNC will produce a list of names, possible candidates, and the governor will choose one of those people and appoint them. Well, what can happen and what has happened in the past is that because of the date that particularly Supreme Court justices, their term expires on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in January. And so it's possible that you have a justice's term expire on the new day, on the very same day that a new governor is taking office. And so then you have a little bit of a question of, okay, is it the outgoing governor who should make the appointment so that there's no vacancy that sits around for too long? Or is it the incoming governor who was just elected by the people who should make the appointment immediately upon taking office? And remember, it's still whether it's the outgoing governor or the incoming governor who makes the decision, he or she is still reliant on the list that the JNC produces. And so they can't go beyond that list. The JNC is most likely a JNC that was appointed, or at least the majority of the folks on the JNC were appointed by the outgoing governor. So that's a reality of how the system currently is. So what complicates this is that in Florida, justices have to retire at the age of 70. And so you do have some justices who might be doing an exceptional job, and unlike the federal court where you can stay on for life, in Florida you have to retire at the age of 70. And so we are facing a situation right now where 4 of 7 members of our state Supreme Court, of our Florida Supreme Court, are facing retirement within the next 4 years. And so that gives Amendment 3 quite a lot of political weight, because if Amendment 3 passes, person who is elected on November 4th, whether that person is Charlie Crist or Rick Scott, will have the power to appoint 4 of 7 Supreme Court justices to Florida's court. So that's something that's quite interesting and definitely, regardless of which side of the political aisle you fall on, makes you realize how important Amendment 3 is. Okay, so Amendment 3 would require a governor to prospectively fill vacancies on the Florida Supreme Court or a district court of appeal when a justice or judge either reaches the mandatory retirement age of 70, fails to qualify for their retention election, or loses their merit retention election. And so you might recall, you'll see questions on the ballot, should Justice Kennedy remain in office, yes or no? If there were to be a situation where a justice actually did not receive a majority of yes votes in that election, this amendment would kick in and that would create a vacancy which would need to be filled. So a vote yes would actually invalidate court interpretations of Florida's Constitution as to who has the authority to fill judicial vacancies. In 2006, there was a Supreme Court interpretation saying that you cannot fill vacancies until that vacancy has actually been created. So you cannot, under the current court's opinion, you cannot prospectively fill vacancies because you can't have two judges in the same seat at the same time. So one judge has to be officially retired or officially their last day has ended. Then the vacancy is created, and then you can appoint someone new. The court has said, though, that in the situation where you know, so for example, in a mandatory retirement situation, you know when that judge or justice's term is going to end. And actually in Florida, a judge or justice's term is 6 years. If they're more than halfway through their term when they turn 70, they don't have to retire on their birthday. They can actually finish out their term. They just won't be able to be eligible for a new term. But you can predict, okay, we know everyone's birthdays, we know when folks will be coming up for retirement. So the JNC for that specific court, whether it's the District Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, they can actually start vetting candidates and having interviews and putting together their list. But currently, the governor is not authorized to select anyone from that list until the day that that vacancy is actually created. So a vote yes on this amendment would change that because you would be able, or the incoming governor, I'm sorry, the current governor, the sitting governor, would be able to appoint before that vacancy has been created. They would basically be able to prospectively appoint even before that person's term has officially ended. So it would enable the outgoing governor to make appointments to the Florida Supreme Court or a district court of appeal. And this is particularly important in that scenario where the term actually ends on the day that a new governor is sworn in. So in that situation, which actually did happen, kind of most, I guess, widely known, it happened in the situation with Justice Peggy Quince's appointment to the Florida Supreme Court. She was someone who had been identified by Governor Lawton Chiles before he passed away as the person who he really wanted to appoint to the court. But the term that she would be filling did not actually become vacant until the day when Governor Jeb Bush was set to be sworn in. And so there was actually a little bit of a tussle between then Governor Chiles and Governor Bush about who would actually be able to have that appointment. Ultimately, they kind of came to a gentleman's agreement that they would co-appoint Justice Quince together. And of course, Governor Chiles did pass away before that actually happened, but that was their agreement. The 2006 Supreme Court decision kind of did say that had that happened more recently, that appointment would have been Governor Bush's to make. So actually, in that case, because Governor Bush was the incoming governor, he should have been able to make that appointment, and there shouldn't have necessarily been this back-and-forth tussle. So a vote yes could also possibly shorten the time of a judicial vacancy, because you basically have already selected the successor before the predecessor has left. And so there would not be a period in which there's a vacancy on the court. So a vote no. A vote no would ensure that a newly sworn in governor would continue to fill prospective judicial vacancies. And it's not even prospective, they would fill vacancies. It would keep language relating to judicial appointments out of the state constitution, where it would be difficult to modify or remove. And a vote no would also continue to allow judicial vacancies to exist for up to 120 days. That's the maximum period in which a judicial vacancy could exist, which could potentially create workload issues for the courts. Again, the 2006 Supreme Court decision said that the JNC could begin the selection process before the vacancy occurs, so it's unlikely that a governor would sit on this decision for 120 days, but it is possible. Okay, so here are the upcoming retirements on the Florida Supreme Court. That was the issue I had mentioned earlier. So you can see that Barbara Perrienti is set to retire in 2019, as is Fred Lewis and Peggy Quince. And then James Perry will be retiring in 2017. So if Amendment 3 passes, the governor elected in 2014 may appoint the majority of the state's Supreme Court, possibly on the day he or she leaves office. And of course, whomever is elected, regardless of whether Amendment 3 passes, whomever is elected on November 4th will appoint the replacement for Justice Perry, because that will happen in 2017. But the 2019 appointments, if Amendment 3 passes, would also be made by that governor, whether it's Rick Scott or Charlie Crist. Okay, so supporting organizations, we don't know of any at this time. The League of Women Voters of Florida is opposing Amendment 3, though, so we have come out on record in opposition. Want to be transparent about our position. And then you'll hear more about local referendums tonight, but if you guys have questions about those, I'm happy to talk about that. We have a website called BeReadyToVote.org, which has a lot of information about the upcoming election. If you're looking for the early voting dates and locations, if you want to check your voter registration status and make sure that your address is up to date, or request the form to change your signature or that type of thing, you can do all of that at BeReadyToVote.org. Today, if you need any help updating your information, I'm happy to do that. I have some voter registration forms in my bag, and I see some other League of Women Voters of Tallahassee members here who I know carry those around with them 24/7. So just flag one of us, and we're happy to help. Of course, the upcoming election is November 4th. Actually, this Monday was the last day to register to vote for the first time. So if you have not already registered to vote in Florida, I am so sorry. But hopefully all of you have, and that's not an issue. And then, of course, we're encouraging everyone to take the pledge to vote and to let their friends and family know. Of course, you can vote by mail. You can vote early during the early voting period, and you can vote on election day. So I think that is it. And if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to take them. Thank you.
Once the governor appoints someone to the judicial nominating committee, can he withdraw them or take away that position? Once elected to that committee or appointed to that committee, can they be removed during that governor's tenure?
I'm pretty sure that they cannot. I'm pretty sure that once appointed, they fill out their four-year term unless they resign or are removed for some type of malfeasance.
On the judicial appointment thing, it's my understanding that that possible workload that might come about is already taken care of. They already have in place the procedure for pushing those cases to lower courts. So that seems to me, if true, that it's not...
So the question was, is there a procedure already in place for potential workload issues that might be created by a vacancy that goes on for too long? And yes, you are correct that there are already procedures for that type of circumstance. Of course, it's not probably quite the same as having a full and robust court of justices, but there are certainly procedures in place in the event that that happens.
Thanks for being here tonight, Jessica. You covered a lot of ground in a short period of time. So would it be accurate to look at Amendment 1 as just returning to our old system of using dock stamps to acquire and protect our lands, or is the new provision going to be significantly different in some way, like maybe a different percentage I'm just trying to figure out if this is just a return to the old system.
Right. So people talk about that a lot in the context of Amendment 1, and actually in many ways it is a return to the old system because essentially back in, well, it's actually happened a couple of times, but so the Land Acquisition Trust Fund is also known as Florida Forever. And then before that, it was known as Preservation 2000. And this was an initiative under Governor Martinez, started in 1990, to essentially preserve, Florida's beautiful conservation land and the areas that people at that time in the late 80s, 90s viewed as very much under threat to development, et cetera. So what the legislature did at that time was they actually purchased bonds. So it was a large bond program. And then they used those bonds to buy hundreds of thousands of acres of conservation land. And it's been over the last, nearly over 25 years, it's been one of the largest land acquisition programs for public lands in the country. It's been hugely successful. And the plan to pay off those bonds was essentially what Amendment 1 does. It was to take revenue from the documentary stamp tax and put that towards paying off those bonds year after year after year. Well, so we actually have now reached the point where those initial bonds have been paid off. And instead of the legislature continuing to put the same amount of money that they were putting towards paying off the bonds towards future land acquisition or even conservation of current land, they have diverted that money to other areas of the budget. So although it hasn't been in the Constitution explicitly this way, it is a continuation of a program that was happening in essentially the same manner that, you were using documentary stamp tax to pay for the land acquisition program through Florida Forever and Preservation 2000. And yes, exactly, roughly the same amount.
Under Amendment 1, if one-third of the documentary stamp tax is redirected to land conservation purposes, what programs are going to lose their current funding, and how are they likely to be refunded? What tax is likely in store for that?
Well, it's a little bit of a, to be honest, it's a little bit of a shell game because this is money that was going into general revenue, and the legislature was, appropriating and as they saw fit. So how the legislature will choose to respond is, really up to the legislature. They could balance the money that is going towards environmental purposes from Amendment 1. They could balance it by saying we're going to spend less on schools, we're going to spend less on roads. They could balance it by saying, okay, we need to increase revenues to cover this, and we're going to, have to increase the fees paid on our registration on our cars, or we're going to eliminate some sales tax exemptions. It'll be up to the legislature to determine how they'll respond to, the demand by the citizens that specific amount of revenue go towards environmental conservation purposes. There are things that the legislature is spending money on now in the ways of environmental conservation. So they could say, well, this project that we're already funding, for example, this year there was a large appropriation for cleaning up the Indian River Lagoon. In the future they might say, okay, we're going to continue to clean up the Indian River Lagoon, and the money that is part of this Amendment 1 pool is, cleaning up the Indian River Lagoon is an appropriate use of that funding. So, it might not be that hard for the legislature to reconcile. But it'll be up to them. That's why we elect them.
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Amendment 2, the medicinal marijuana. And a few years back, I lost my wife to cancer after a prolonged fight with that cancer. And we went through the OxyContin and the oxycodone and the morphine and the morphine pump and the morphine plus OxyContin. And truly, the last year was an extremely difficult year of suffering. And, we were asked at that time, it was presented to us by certain people that, people use marijuana to help that situation and relieve suffering. And we were told 23 states already allowed that. But I never really found anything that showed whether or not it was effective in terms of pain. And my wife certainly didn't do it because it was illegal here. But is there anything out there that can tell us whether or not and how effective it's been in those 23 other states that allow it? Do you know?
So I have to be honest, I actually haven't seen the medical research and probably wouldn't want to speak to something that I'm not well-versed in. So I don't know exactly, what medical research has been done or how, some of the big medical organizations or doctors groups, would respond to that question.
Okay, but there, it is true that it wouldn't, if somebody had medicinal marijuana, they couldn't drive a car, they couldn't drive a boat, like you said, or heavy equipment. I mean, is that any different than other medicines that are given, like OxyContin? They shouldn't be doing that either. I mean, that's the same situation then that would exist for medicinal marijuana as exists for all these other treatments, right?
In terms of being considered regulated and you're not being able to, operate machinery, et cetera, I would think that it would be similar to other controlled substances, yes.
Thank you so much, Jessica. I know that I would really like it if you could come with me and consult when I go vote. It would be very useful. Thanks. Don't have anything else to do. So I'm going to go ahead and ask the ethics panel to come on up, and I'll say a few words while you're getting in place. Sit behind the appropriate name. Find yours. All right, so I wanted to say a word about, if you'll look in the middle of your table, we've got some of the referendum language there so that you know exactly what it will read and what we're talking about. I also want to say a word about some resources we have out in the audience as we start our discussion. City Commissioner Nancy Miller, give a wave, is here. City Manager Anita Favors-Thompson. City Attorney Lou Shelley. Assistant City Attorney Cassandra Jackson. Bert Fletcher, the City Auditor. And Julie Meadows-Keefe, the Ethics Officer. Did I get everybody? So anyway, you can introduce yourself. And so they're sitting over there. If you have questions that you want to ask them too, then feel free to go ahead. So introducing the panel, from your left to right, is Marilyn Wills of the Citizens Ethics Advisory Panel and one of the co-founders of Citizens for Ethics Reform, which is the organization that got this measure on the ballot. Next to her is Catherine Baer of the Tea Party Network and another co-founder of Citizens for Ethics Reform. Peter Butzin of Common Cause of Florida. City Commissioner Scott Maddox. Jay Landers, also of the Citizens Ethics Advisory Panel. And Mike Sittig of the Florida League of Cities. And I also want to say a word about Jeff Berlew. Give a little wave here. Jeff is going to be helping Bob with questions. And just as a reminder, if you have written questions, just hold them up anytime. We'll be on the back and we'll see you. If you have a question you want to ask in person, then go ahead and just give us a nod and we'll be there for you. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator for the evening, Tallahassee Democrat editor Bob Gabordi. And here.
Well, hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Jessica, you did a great job. You really did. So we had some conversations beforehand about how this was going to work, and we're going to, throw that out and start over, I guess. But the way that we're going to do it from the beginning is each person will introduce themselves and talk for about a minute, minute and 15 seconds, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, to sort of stake out their position. Because while there is general agreement and disagreement, they come from very different places in many cases. And so we want you to have the opportunity to hear from them exactly sort of where they're coming from. I also have asked each of them that if I do anything that feels less than fair or isn't, the right role for the moderator to tell me, that I have been embarrassed in public many, many times. And I'm not afraid of that, because the idea here is that we really just want to have a conversation as a community to try to create better understanding of what is on the ballot and what the implications are. So I also want to acknowledge Leslie Smith from the Tallahassee Democrat is here. She's going to be one of the people carrying the microphones, and Kate Schofield is videoing for us, and it's live on the internet on Tallahassee.com. You'll also be able to see a recorded version of this if you want to just go back and look at all or part of it. And also, Tamarin Waters is here reporting. Hi, Tamarin. And so with that, we'll get started. After the initial conversation, maybe one or two questions up here, we really want this to be about you engaging with them, and so we're going to go quickly into questions. As Liz said, and Liz has one of the microphones as well, that if you feel comfortable asking the question, fine. Sort of moderate yourself to make sure that you can ask it relatively quickly, because we want it to be about the conversation and not about the question. If you feel more comfortable, simply write it down, and they'll bring it up to Jeff, and we'll ask the question for you. I think it, point, counterpoint, so you all being the point, why don't we start with you, and you can go first.
All right, my name is Marilyn Wills. I'm a retired math teacher. I taught at Leon High School for 28 years and also coached cross country. And I served as an alternate on the Ethics Advisory Panel. And I became involved in Citizens for Ethics Reform when, after serving on the panel for a matter of months, the major proposal of the panel was rejected by the commission by a 3-2 vote. And that was to have an independent ethics officer who did not answer to the city commission, but would answer to the citizens of Tallahassee. While the city commission is to be commended for placing many of the panel's recommendations in the ordinance, the failure to make the ethics officer independent is really a fatal blow. In a letter to the city treasurer, the former city auditor listed several reasons why the auditor's office should not be responsible for the ethics office. The threat of self-interest, where a financial interest might inappropriately influence the auditor's judgment or behavior, since the auditor is evaluated and compensation is determined by the city commission. The familiarity threat, a close or long relationship with personnel would affect his objectivity. And last, a structural threat, where the auditor would be evaluating the actions of one or more city commissioners in some cases, who are also his boss.
Okay, so that was about perfect. So if you all can sort of copy Marilyn in terms of the time, that would be great.
My name is Catherine Baer, and I am the chair of the Tea Party Network, which is a coalition of about 85 Tea Party conservative 912 organizations across the state of Florida. If I'm talking too fast, just tell me to slow down, because I have a tendency to just buzz on. And that probably falls right in line with the fact that I am a commercial pilot. I'm married to a commercial pilot who flies the EMS helicopter, so if he buzzes us tonight, he's probably telling me I'm talking too long. We moved from Germany to Tallahassee in 2005 when my husband retired from the Army. And we love Tallahassee. One of the reasons that I got involved in this is because ethics is a very costly subject. And if you don't know that, it's very costly. Let me explain to you a little bit about that. A 2014 study from the University of Indiana cites that corruption in politics, which is the lack of ethics, costs the individual taxpayer $1,300 a year for corruption at the state level. That translates to about $260 million for the roughly 200,000 Leon County residents. Corruption is expensive, make no doubt about that. So that's part of why I am involved in this.
Thank you, Catherine.
And I am Peter Butzine. I am state chair of Common Cause in Florida. I also serve on its national governing board. I came to Tallahassee back in 1973 as a campus minister at Florida State University, and I have been devoting my life subsequently to raising a couple of now grown daughters. I also started a software company, and I worked in a variety of different capacities, both paid and unpaid, for Common Cause. Did you ever think you'd see the Tea Party, the League of Women Voters, and Common Cause all in the same place? Here we are, and we're here. And I'm here because I've been kind of an ethics junkie, working with Common Cause, which tries to hold government accountable to the public interest. I'm here because I want to see elections and government working in the best interests of the people and not in the interests of special interests. And I've dedicated my life to that, and I am particularly interested in supporting this amendment on this ballot at this time because, quite frankly, I know that Congress is broken, and the Florida legislature is near broken. And as a result, our local governments take on more and more power, and that's good. But we've got to make sure that those local governments are working for the people and not for special interest groups. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Scott.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to do this in a minute and a half, but Mike Sittig has told me I could have his time if I run over.
Well, I have Jeff being, you know, he's got the clock. So.
Oh, don't start me yet, Jeff. I'm not starting yet. Thank you very much for having me here. And basically, I want to talk about kind of the facts that because they're being wildly misrepresented in the debate. So I'd like to kind of bring those out. With all deference to Ms. Wills, who was my 11th grade geometry teacher, I'm going to have to correct some facts from her. But she made me correct enough math problems that that's okay, I think. Ms. Wills said that the ethics committee recommended a ethics officer that is independent and does not answer to the city commission, and the city commission did not follow that. That is patently false. It is absolutely wrong. The committee recommended that you add an appointed official that is directly hired by the city commission. So they would be answerable only to the city commission. I voted for that. It was a 3-2 vote. The commission instead decided to go with an ethics officer that would answer to two of the appointed officials. Nowhere was there a vote nor a recommendation from the committee to have an ethics officer that was answerable to anyone else other than the city commission. In fact, their recommendation was to have the ethics officer answerable to the city commission. It's being misrepresented wildly. And I hate to take opposition to the Tallahassee Democrat, which I think is the best newspaper in the state of Florida. And I'm a proud subscriber for a long time. But in the ethics editorial that was written by the Democrat, it says, as the city commission was debating the issues, Ms. Barnett told the commissioners, if you don't create a standalone ethics officer, you'll take away the heart of this proposal. But they did just that. Well, the standalone ethics officer there that Ms. Barnett was talking about was answerable directly to the city commission. Further in the editorial, it says that the city went to court to block the measure, saying it was unclear and ambiguous. The city lost. The city did not go to court to block the measure. The city went for a deck action, a declaratory action about the language, the same thing they've done with other referendums that have come before the city. Should the city have wanted to block it, all we had to do is vote to appeal it. We voted to appeal it. It was gone because it would have been after the November election. It would have been another election cycle. I'm almost there, Bob.
Okay. You'll get a chance, Scott, to go deeper. So, in fairness.
Okay, well, I thought we were going a minute and a half, and then we're going to questions.
You're at about 3 minutes, so.
Go ahead.
Thanks. My name is Jay Landers. I would mention, since the amendments were put on before us, that reminds me, in terms of introducing myself to you, that I was the first Secretary of Department of Environmental Regulation, I hate to say this, 40 years ago. I was with Governor Askew on his staff, and that's when a lot of the land acquisition programs for the state of Florida really got started. and Florida has had the best land acquisition program in the country. And this would be a continuation of that. The Amendment 1, and I definitely urge you to support it and ask other people to support it. I was on the Ethics Advisory Panel, and what Scott said is correct. There was a minority position in terms of, well, let me just set the background. We, as a panel, met something like 18 or 19 times over 8 or 9 months. We operated by consensus, and we agreed on every single thing, including the establishment of a state ethics officer. The only thing that we disagreed on is how this should be structured. And it comes down to, I mean, the word independent is being used. And the people who are supporting this say, you know, we've got to have an independent ethics officer. Well, you know, what is your definition of independent? That's what it boils down to. They are saying that if this is someone who answers, they wanted it to be an appointed official, like the city manager, the city attorney, the city clerk, and the city auditor. All of those people are hired and fired directly by the city commission. So they have no career service protection. On any type of political whim, they could be fired. And if you have an ethics officer that's in that position, how does an ethics officer start an investigation with people that hire and fire you? It's not easy. So I didn't think that was independent. What we proposed was that there would be a city employee that would work for either the city attorney or the auditor, and that that person would have career service protection so that that person could pursue any type of ethical action, including that of a city commissioner, because they were protected in the career service position. To me, that was more independent, and that's what this whole thing boils down to.
Good evening. My name's Mike Sittig. I am not representing my employer tonight. These are my personal opinions. Since Watergate, we have, in this state, passed dozens of reforms to increase the confidence in government. Most of them fall under the ethical subject matter umbrella. Voting conflicts, campaign finance reform, gift ban, financial disclosure, government in the sunshine, the creation of the Ethics Commission, and none of them have worked. When Nixon resigned, the public's confidence in government, the negatives, there was 25% of the people in this country that said they had no confidence in elected officials, little or no confidence, and today it's 50%. Now, these reforms over the last 40 years, I supported a lot of them, but upon reflection, I think that in retrospect that they have contributed to the decrease in the public's confidence in government, because we've had this 40-year drum roll that if somebody decides to offer themselves up for public service, it must be for some personal gain. And so we have to constantly make sure that they never get a meal. They have to do financial disclosure. When, by the way, in 40 years, I don't ever remember a financial disclosure, an error on a financial disclosure that led to a voting conflict, ever. And 38,000 people a year file financial disclosure forms. So I think that it's a solution in search of a problem. And you're chasing good people away from running for office.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. So we'll quickly get to your questions. So be prepared for that. So I said that we'll get a chance to go deeper with some of these things. And I want to start with this whole concept of what's an independent, you know, ethics officer versus, you know, and how you get there. Because it seems to me, you know, that whether the person is hired by staff or hired by commission, there's someone that they're answerable to. It's unavoidable. So how do we get past that? And also, before you answer that, I want to I've neglected to do at least one thing, and that is to make sure that you all know that Lou Shelley, the city attorney, is here, And I understand that he may even be willing to answer a question if it comes up. So I had forgotten to do that earlier and remembered halfway through my question that Lou might be able to help us with some of that too. So, how, you know, and I guess I'll start with this side of the panel to talk about that whole idea of what makes one more independent than the other and why that is so critically important from your point of view. And anyone that wants to can jump in and answer, and then we'll go to that side, and then just let it be a conversation.
Yeah, I'd be happy to try that. Let me tell you what independent is not. In my opinion, independent is not working for the city attorney and the city auditor. In my opinion, independence means working for an independent board. And the board that this proposed charter amendment would create is an independent board. And I can explain why that is, but I don't want to take up too much time. But it's appointed by leaders in the city of Tallahassee. And so we have the situation where, and incidentally, Julia Meadows Keefe is in the audience. She's our new ethics officer. We wish her well. I am sure she is profoundly qualified for the position that she's in. But I noticed that when she was recently interviewed by the Tallahassee Democrat, she said that she regarded the city commission and the city employees as her clients. Now, I'm not trying to pick on you, Julie. And if I were in your position, I would have said the same thing because I know who hires me and who fires me. But really, your position, the clients are the people of Tallahassee. And if we want a truly independent commission, we need to establish an independent board that you're answerable to and not city employees or city commissioners.
When Ms. Wills was talking, she was talking about what the advisory committee had recommended. And what they had recommended was an ethics officer that was hired by the city commission, as Commissioner Maddox mentioned. That is not truly an independent ethics officer. When you're hired and fired by the people that you are possibly investigating, you are beholden to those guys. You're for lack of a better word, you're merely a lapdog rather than a watchdog. What we have proposed is one step beyond what the advisory committee proposed. We propose an independent ethics officer with an independent ethics board. Now, what happens here is this ethics board is put together by citizens like us. And the people that are actually putting that together is the city commission gets to appoint one person. The chief justice for the second judicial circuit appoints one person. The state attorney for the second judicial court appoints one person. The presidents of FAMU and the presidents of FSU appoint one person. That's five people. Those people get together and they appoint two more people. That makes a total of seven for this ethics board. This ethics board, in turn, hires an ethics officer. That ethics officer answers to this board, and they are the ones who are going to be initiating ethics investigations or whatever those investigations might look like, but they'll be doing training and other things like that. This makes that ethics officer and that ethics board report to you, the citizens, and not the people that are hiring them.
That will have to be the last word for the broadcast portion of our program tonight. This was recorded live at St. John's Episcopal Church in downtown Tallahassee. The Village Square is committed to civil and constructive public dialogue on the issues that matter to our community, our state, and our nation. Find the remainder of tonight's conversation online at tothevillagesquare.org. Thank you for joining us, and good night.
Join us next time for another visit to the Village Square on WFSU-FM.